Good morning. This meeting of the House Education Committee will come to order. Today is Monday, April 15th, 2019, and the time is 8:04. Members of House Education present are Co-Chair Representative Harriet Drummond, Representative Delana Johnson, Representative Greyer Hopkins, Representative Josh Rivak, and Representative Tiffany Silkowski, and myself, Representative Andy Story. We have a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, I'd like to remind everyone to silence their cell phones. Today, our recording secretary is Selman Holland, and Madison Truitt is our LIO moderator, assisting with our tech and teleconferencing support. Thank you both. Today on the agenda, we will hear from Dr. Dana DeFeo with the Institute for Social and Economic Research, who will address the issues of education costs in Alaska. We also have online ICER staff who are available for questions. We have Lexi Hill and Matt Berman. Dr. DeFeo, thank you for being with us today. Please come forward and begin. And I spoke with Dr. DeFeo before the meeting, and she said it is fine to ask questions as we go along today. So thank you. Oh, and I'd like to say Representative Chris Tuck is here with us too. Thank you. Back in order. Thank you. Please go ahead, Dr. DeFeo.
Thank you so much and for the invitation. My name is Dana DeFeo. I'm the director of the Center for Alaska Education Policy Research. That's at the Institute of Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska Anchorage. And okay, I'm a little soft-spoken, as I've been told. So that's who I am, but I wanted to let you know that in developing this presentation, I got input from a lot of my colleagues because the question that was posed is a complex one. I'm not a school finance expert. I'm not an expert in employee benefits like healthcare. I'm not an expert in energy. A lot of these things drive the cost of education in Alaska, but the individuals who are named on this slide at ICER have a lot of expertise in these areas. So they've given input to what I'm going to say, and I'm confident in the content that I'm presenting. However, some of the follow-up questions that you may have, they would be singularly poised to answer them better than I do, so I will defer to those individuals online or take follow-up questions and get back to you, depending on, I know some stuff, so I'll be able to speak to my content expertise as well. So the outline I had for today's presentation, I wanted to start looking briefly at the Alaska education context, then exploring what it is that we do pay for education in Alaska and K-12, of course, looking at the question, do we really pay that much more than the U.S. average, and then look at some of the questions around what drives the costs in our state and maybe where are some areas of opportunity. I was asked on Thursday to bring in some student achievement data. I didn't have time to pull that in at the level that I would have liked to with that much notice, but I will give input where the data are readily available, and I'm happy to follow up on questions such as how all of this relates to student achievements and where we had data, where we've done research at ICER. I've worked that in as much as I could. So as context, and this is, I'm sure, familiar to you, We've got just about 130,000 students in the K-12 public school system. 22% of them are indigenous, and when you move to rural Alaska, the numbers are much higher. The majority of students there are indigenous. Alaska also has a high homeschool population, higher than most other states at about 10%. We've got just over 500 public schools, and they are most of their funding comes from the state. We'll look at how that breaks down in a little bit. And those students in the state are distributed across the state's geography, even though most of them proportion-wise attend in the urban areas. We've got a tremendous number of students in rural and remote rural Alaska.
Madam Chair.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Ms. DeFeo. You mentioned that Alaska has a high homeschool population.
That's right.
Do you know if you distinguish the homeschool population that is served through charter schools and regular school districts as opposed to homeschoolers whose families are doing it on their own?
I apologize. Let's just say through the chair, even though I know you're the co-chair. The statistic I'm citing is coming from, I believe the author is McKittrick. I can take a closer look at that and get back to you to break down that 10%. I happen to be doing some research and looking at high school students who are homeschooled, and there's a lot of complexity in the homeschool definition, and so we've got the public homeschools and a variety. So I would like to defer and bring back later a better breakdown. Should I continue? Okay. So the state funds schools, as you know, with 10 or more students. With that requirement, we've about a dozen schools have closed in the last 10 years. And in the state of Alaska, we've got no Bureau of Indian Education or tribally operated public schools, and that will matter when we talk about the cost of education and the spending when we talk about revenues in the next slide or two. So the Alaska exceptionality, we have a lot of diversity in Alaska, and that diversity challenges us when we're looking at anything in aggregate, in comparison, when we look at averages, when we look at small sample sizes. We encounter some methodological threats. We have some challenges in interpreting data when we have so much diversity that we're trying to put into one big pot. So when I moved to Alaska, I heard all of the time, we're different from other places, we're unique, and we're very proud of that. As I see it underscored in our education system, how the Common Core state standards, we decided to not use the national ones. We have Alaska-specific standardized tests. And all of that makes us special, but I think that it's important to remember that we need to be careful then when comparing our inputs or our outputs to other states that use those metrics and measures. And for example, NAEP testing, that looks at two things. It looks at students and asks with the content, do they know it? But the follow-up question is, can they apply it in the testing context? And those, so our differences and our diversity makes it sometimes hard to look at these standardized measures. And the answer in Alaska to a lot of questions is, it depends. It depends on the context. So I was going to pause here and move to the question of what do we pay? I was told that you are quite familiar with the foundation formula, so I can go through that quite quickly if that would be what you would like. So Alaska education funding, we've got state general fund. A high proportion of our total funding or spending comes from the state, about 65%. Incidentally, yesterday in the airport, I was reading some work that my colleague, Dr. Berman, who's on the line, had done in the 90s, and he had suggested I add a pie chart to this slide that I hadn't put in before. And I pulled this 1991 paper and was sort of skimming it, and the pie chart that he had made in 91 looked exactly the same. I mean, I want to say the numbers were almost exactly 65, 22, and 12% by state, local, and federal funding. So I was amused at how solid and steady this has been. But we've got, looking at our other revenue sources, we've got federal revenues. Because we don't have Bureau of Indian Ed schools, that limits the number of federal dollars that we receive for indigenous students. especially looking at other states that have high indigenous population, we have a much smaller amount of federal dollars coming in for those students. But we do receive federal grant dollars. We have local contributions going into our education revenues. But of course, the REAAs don't have tax capacity, and so they don't collect those dollars. And then we have other small revenue streams and investment earnings and in-kind services. And my colleagues who are much more familiar with all of this are online. If you have follow-up questions here, I'm pleased that they are.
Representative Gray, Hopkins.
Thank you. Just quickly, what does that pie chart breakdown generally look like for some other typical states on average?
So, through the chair, I would like to ask if Matt, who's Matt Berman or Lexi Hill, would have an immediate answer that's more accurate than I can give.
Yes, Mr. Berman or Ms. Hill.
Hello, Representative Tuck. That was the person who asked the question. I can't remember who it was. Sorry, this is Matt Berman, ISER in Anchorage.
It was Representative Hopkins.
Hopkins, okay. Well, as Representative Hopkins, that's a good question, and it Alaska is near the in the upper tier, but not by any means. It's not at the top. The state in Hawaii, there is only one school district, so 100% of the schools in Hawaii are state. There's no, it's all state funded. So. But Alaska is near the top. The average is much closer to like half and half, but it really varies a lot by state.
Thank you.
Should I continue? Okay,
please.
So again, and this is a familiar context, is looking quickly at how we come up with general funding spending. We start with the base student allocation that's set by the legislature. It's increased about 8% in the last 10 years, not adjusting for inflation, so it's been relatively flat. And we'd like to note there's not been an adequacy study to help us determine the actual need that goes into the base student allocation. And there was one called for, I think, in 2014 in HB 278, but it was never completed. And there's an area of opportunity. I can talk to that a little more later in the presentation. But what we do is we apply the school foundation formula to determine what we actually spend. And as Dr. Berman pointed out, this has been in place since at least the 1980s, but in the last 20 years, in the 90s, McDowell revised the size adjustment. In 2002, AIR developed the structure for the current school foundation formula, including the cost differential. And ICER, my institute, developed community cost differentials in 2005. They've not been updated since. And that's an important point to make because our state has changed quite a bit since 2005. Some communities have changed a lot more than others. So we're working now on those 2005 numbers. In 2015, we did develop community cost differentials as they relate to teacher salaries, but those were not implemented. So those are available as a point of comparison.
Excuse me, we have two questions. Representative Zilkowski.
Thank you. So the cost differential didn't come into play in the foundation formula until 2002, is that correct?
Through the chair, that is my understanding, but if Matt Berman or Lexi, who were working here at that time, would like to correct me, I would welcome that if I misspoke.
Thank you. Moment, we have Representative Drummond next, but I just wanted to see if anyone online had a comment on that last question.
Hi, this is Lexi Hill. Am I audible?
Yes, you are. Please go ahead.
I was just going to say, and Matt would remember far better than I, what cost differentials might have been in play before 2002, but the structure of the formula changed at that time. AIR did a whole bunch of research, good research, I might add, and put in a pretty statistically sophisticated cost differential, which has like 13 columns, and it's complex. And so We tend to go back to there and stop there because the formula was really different before that. But I think there have been cost differentials right along, but I'm not deeply familiar with them.
Thank you. Representative Drummond was next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. DeFeo, you mentioned that ICER is now working on a cost differential update. Who can give me some feedback on that?
Through the chair, if I said that, I misspoke. In 2015, we developed cost differential update, and we put that out. And it might have been linked in the package that was prepared to you. If not, I can certainly send the link to the full study. At present, we're not working on updates, though we recognize that they need to be updated, and we'd be happy to do that work.
Thank you.
With support for that, of course. It's no easy task to do those updates.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to point out that in 2007, we had the Joint Legislative Education Task Force, and there was recommendations. That was during the Bain administration. I think it was 2007. And there was recommendations on increasing the base student allocation by $200. And there was also a shifting that it ended up only being $100 in the end. The legislature passed a $100 base student allocation increase. And then there was also reallocation they redid the multipliers for special education in different areas also. So I think that was probably something that we want to mention on here also, is that was another benchmark moment where we were able to do something different with the base student allocation. And I don't remember all the details of that. That's just off the top of my head. I know that we went from like 3 times.
13 to 13.
13.
To 13.
I'm sorry, say again?
Yes, for special ed students, it's 13 times.
Mm-hmm. Right, but I think it was at 5 times at that time. Okay. Then went up to 13.
Okay.
There was some things that happened at that time period.
Yeah, and Representative Drummond and Chair, that's intensive special needs students, mm-hmm. or intensive.
Yes. Yes.
Please continue.
Thank you. I should note or would add, you reminded me that there have been a couple of calls for these cost differentials, the community cost differentials, to be updated. I believe it was the Association of Alaska School Boards that's called for updating them, as well as ACSA recently, because they are a bit old.
Representative Drummond.
I'm sure not only the State Association of School Boards, but I know the Anchorage Municipal Assembly has
yes.
been looking for an update. What does it take to trigger a full update of the cost differential and have ICER do it?
So through the chair, this is something I can speak quite well to. We've had a couple of meetings. So our concern is that when you update these cost differentials, and I'll share what they are on a map presently later in this presentation, is that there are communities and districts that will fare better and communities and districts that will fare worse. So ICER's concern in doing this study, should we do it, is that it would need to be legislatively mandated and not driven by a particular district or a city that would stand to, because we would want people to realize that they are nonpartisan and that they are done with integrity and not to benefit any particular community in particular. That said, I think we drew up a cost estimate that I hate to go on record and say, actually, if Lexi Hill is at a computer, she might be able to pull it. But I want to say that it was on the order of $130,000 to do the cost differential updates using some.
Hi, this is Lexi Hill.
Please.
Dana's about right. It was between $130,000 and
$150,000.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
And I believe, if I can add, that we wanted about a 6-month time frame if when we scoped that out. Was that correct, Lexi?
Yes, that's correct.
So,
Representative Drummond.
Thank you. The Anchorage Municipal Assembly actually set aside, I want to say, in the neighborhood of $140,000 to contribute to that study. And I know that they weren't intending for them to particularly benefit,
sure.
But they understand that it needs to be done, and Anchorage had the wherewithal to help pay for it. And I would like to find a way to begin this process
No matter who pays for it, ICERN needs to do it. I'd just like to know how we can get that process started.
And through the chair, I didn't mean to suggest that anybody was trying to game the system. We were concerned about the optics of it, that it come through the legislation or come through a statewide organization that had a lot of broad support from a variety of districts and whatnot. So we're happy to do the work. We're happy to do it with the funding that you mentioned, as long as it's generally backed by the legislature and or one of these larger state organizations.
Thank you. And Co-Chair Drummond, we can talk about that another time about how that we can help make that process happen. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. Here it says that the BSA has increased about 8% in the last 10 years, not adjusting for inflation. Do you have any idea off the top of your head how that would have kept up with inflation, or has that dropped our, and you might get into this later, has that dropped our state's proportion of what we spend down at all in terms of per capita, or how has that number impacted us historically over the last 10 years?
So through the chair, our state spending, I think, is affected more in terms of how we rank by how other states are investing in education where their economy is booming in the lower 48. But what inflation would be over the last 10 years, could I defer to the economist on the line, to Dr. Berman, to speak to that? With more accuracy, I could guess, but why guess when you've got?
Sure. Thank you. Yes, Dr. Berman, please go ahead.
So the question about the cost of living in general, or the cost of spending on education?
How does the cost says here that the base student allocation has increased by about 10% in the last 10 years. And I was wondering how that account, compared to inflation, because it's not pegged to that at all.
It's less than inflation. So the prices have risen less rapidly in Alaska than in other states on average, but more than 8% over the past 10 years. And also, I just said while we're here, just mentioned that the numbers that Dr. DeFeo is showing there are from the 2015-2016 school year. And that's because those are the latest numbers that the federal statistics are available for all the states, so we can compare Alaska to other states. And in the past 3 years or 4 years, Alaska is probably, other states are spending more, but we don't have the exact numbers. So it's sort of a slow decline, but we don't have the numbers to be able to tell you exactly how much of a change it is, whether it's like 5% or 10% or something like that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I understand you've heard about the school foundation formula and been briefed. So in a nutshell, it starts with the base student allocation. It makes three categories of adjustments for differences among schools, and that is school size, the school cost, the district cost factor, and then adjustment for certain programs, as Representative Tuck had mentioned. Another type of program, vocational education is also in there, or career and technical education, as well as the homeschool adjustment, things like that. So that adjustment is quite similar to other states. And then, of course, the foundation formula determines the total amount and the distribution of the funds, and it includes lots of things like federal payments in lieu of taxes. It includes hold harmless provisions. It excludes extra local contribution. I envision sort of a meat grinder when I think about it, but when I've looked at all of these tables, it makes a lot of sense. There's just a lot to it, but I think these three bullets on the left-hand side really are the key focus of today's presentation. And as Dr. Berman said, the latest numbers that we have where we can compare to other states are 2016 from the U.S. Census Bureau, so that's what we used as the base for this presentation today. And using those numbers, average per pupil school spending is $17,510. And we'll look at how we compare in relation to other states. But to put that in context, I just quickly looked at some private school tuition in Anchorage, and tuition is in italics because that does not account for other revenues that the schools get, like donations. Private school tuition is $13,815 at Pacific Northern Academy, $10,700 at Anchorage Montessori, and this is Anchorage too. Their costs are lower to the rest of the state. They have different student populations. They don't necessarily have to accept intensive special education students, and they provide different services to students. Daycare costs, I just heard an estimate that these range about $1,000 a month for families in Anchorage, and that's just custodial care. So when I look at these numbers, 17.5 doesn't seem so far off. But we'll go ahead and compare this, our spending, to other states. And this slide, oh, I'm glad that bar on the side allows you to see my call-out buttons. So this is the 2016 per pupil spending according to the Census Bureau's Survey of School Finance Systems. Alaska ranks number 6. And to help you see better, I added also the average. I understand it's really hard to read the individual state names, but I thought just to step back and see the big picture, I put them all on there. So that's where we are.
Excuse me, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just had a question on this. It looks like you're using the U.S. Census Bureau data.
Yes.
And that was a number I think we got. Is a 54%, is that the 54% versus the 76% of the that goes into the classroom? So we're using the U.S. Census data instead of the Department of Education data, and that's over all the states in this chart.
Through the chair, that is the source of the data mm-hmm. here, and so the way the spending is broken down, it's a little small to see. You can see instruction is sort of dark green and light green, and instruction staff support is light blue. What goes into all of that is available in the survey, and I'd be happy to send you those components, but what percent breaks down to instruction, I couldn't speak to that directly. It's kind of interesting to look at these school budgets that have so much to them and think that we put every single thing that's spent on into 7 different categories. And so I think that we could really argue what types of costs belong where. But looking at this one here, and I'm just looking, this one looks close to the 54% designation. Mm-hmm. As it classifies those.
My follow-up is there's been maybe a little bit of a disagreement on what amount should go be attributed to the classroom. And I recognize you got census data up here. You're not mm-hmm. driving this with your own data. Is there any, does ICER have any opinion, or have they looked into what really is considered classroom expense? I mean, because there's multiple categories, and what you pick to attribute to the classroom is different depending on what data that you look at.
Dr. DeFeo, I don't know if you're aware, but we had a presentation by the Alaska School Business Officials a couple weeks ago now, maybe, and they broke down the Alaska budget going to education into different categories and came up with 76%. So you might want to look at that at one point. We'll make sure you get that information and can possibly follow up later if you have any comments on that. Thank you.
On that
Representative point. Drummond.
Yeah. The state business officials use the chart of accounts that the State Department of Education sets out. Mm-hmm. And I'm still seeing about 2/3 here. If you go instruction employee salaries, benefits, instruction staff support, and pupil support, mm-hmm. that's all into the classroom. Mm-hmm. And that's easily 2/3 of this chart. And I have yet to see somebody prove the 54% census numbers. And your chart doesn't support 54% census numbers either. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Please continue.
So to your question, I think that there's two questions. What should be counted as an instructional expenditure, and what we should spend as instructional expenditures are two different ones. I would certainly be happy to provide a breakdown of, in this chart, what got counted where. One of the things that was useful for us in developing the presentation was to look particularly at instruction employee salaries and instruction employee benefits, because those often tend to be a topic of conversation in the state. And that separation out, as it's done in this accounting system, gives us a bit to talk about around policy here.
Representative Zukowski.
Sorry, Madam Chair. It's okay. It's early Monday morning. I think what I hear is maybe a discussion among my colleagues around sourcing information and maybe trying to understand better the rationale behind why ICER has opted to use the information that you've used and what other information exists, and how can we make sure that we're measuring apples to apples and not apples to oranges when it comes to the cost of education. And so maybe something that would be worthwhile, and again, this is not a question to put you on the spot, but maybe a great opportunity for follow-up with our committee, is to maybe provide some rationale behind why ICER has opted to use the data sources that you have, just because there is not alignment with some of the numbers that we've seen. I anticipate that some of it is, you know, coming from a research institution versus coming from sure. school business officials, and so that seems to be some of the disconnect that I'm hearing, and maybe a good opportunity for follow-up.
Sure. And through the chair, I would say we pulled these for this presentation alone, so these are not the numbers that we've used in some of our other calculations. I would also add that this chart sort of nicely breaks down spending into seven categories, but the total length of the bar, if we were to focus on that, the $17,510 per pupil should end up being the same across these different accounting systems, and so for what it's worth. But I would be happy to to talk about it. What's nice with the census data is that it allows us to do these comparisons between states with a little bit more context than just straight up numbers. Happy to look a little bit further if you'd like. But if we take that 17,510 and we for less than instructional and non-instructional costs, we wanted to look at that total cost and what we spend. We did want to look and see how our spending relates or compares to the U.S. average. And when Dr. Berman looked at this slide, and I had already sent it to you, he goes, that's a lot more complicated than it needs to be. Why don't you just say that, one, there's a high cost of living in rural Alaska, which skews the statewide average, and second, that even in urban Alaska, living costs are higher than the U.S. average. And I said, okay, I can say that, but I can't change the slide at this point. So just looking at these numbers, we've got, high cost in parts of our state skews our state average, and our state is going to be higher than the national average just because our cost of living is higher. So here are the community cost differentials that I spoke to earlier. These are the ones that were developed by ICER in 2005. I apologize that the graphic is a little fuzzier than I wish it were, but
Excuse me for a second. Representative Tuck.
Oh, sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just need to flip back. I made my flip back too far. There we go. On the $17,510 per average on slide 13, do you have the numbers broken out for Anchorage or Matsu by any chance? Because I think when we're looking at, when you look at the average, I mean, there's going to be some very costly places in remote areas of Alaska. And when I look at the chart on 11, which is the spending per pupil, when you look at those five states that are above Alaska, you have Vermont, New Jersey, Connecticut, D.C., and New York, which are heavy populated states in comparison to Alaska. So you would think that the cost per economies of scale, the cost per student would go down, but we actually see for these areas it's pretty high. And so I'd like to be able to, if you have the number, be able to compare that to like Anchorage, which is our biggest city.
Through the chair, absolutely. We did calculate that. I don't have it in my notes off the top of my head, and I hate to say anything off the – I recall it was around $14,000 per student. I don't know if Dr. Berman recalls, because it was with him that I was speaking to when we were doing these calculations, and that was the Anchorage number, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know if he recalls. something more precise.
Dr. Berman, did you want to collaborate that? Dr. Berman, are you online?
This is Matt Berman. I'm sorry, I had my I had it muted at my end, so I was talking and nobody could hear. I'd be hesitant to give you an exact number, but it's what's important to understand with these numbers is not the, you know, the actual number includes certain types of expenditures, but not others, it is important to compare apples to apples, and so the $17,510 number is a figure for current, what's called current spending. So it includes non-class, it includes spending that the school districts put on that isn't directly related to instruction, but it does not include debt service and capital outlays. And those those sometimes vary from district to district. An Anchorage school district does do, like, you know, anything that the school district is spending that it gets reimbursed from other sources for putting on events, for example, is probably included in those numbers. And to be precise, you probably need to summon the school business officers back and have them explain the details, because it's beyond me. But these numbers come from a questionnaire that the Census Bureau sends to all school districts in the country every year, with asking them to report revenues and expenditures in various categories, and those categories are the same for all districts in the country. And so we absolutely can provide you the actual numbers for Anchorage for any year, because they're published here, but they're really in the fine print, and it would take some work to extract them. So I'd be hesitant to tell you the exact number today on the phone. Okay. I'll probably tell you tomorrow, though, if you want to follow up by email. Thanks.
Would you like that, Representative Tuck?
Yes, if I may, and I don't mean to put any work on the university on this, but it'd be just nice to know, because Anchorage does happen to be our biggest metropolitan area in Mat-Su Valley, so if we can break out those two, it would be helpful. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Berman, you said that the Census Bureau requests these numbers of every school district. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes, Representative Drummond. The data are publicly available for every school district in the nation. So the data come in the file that have, you know, thousands of school districts, and that's why I can't give you the answer right off the top of my head, because it would take sifting through the numbers to find the school districts. But I could probably give you those numbers for every school district in Alaska.
Follow up, yes. So therefore, does your Alaska average include every school district in Alaska?
It does include every school district in Alaska. I'm not sure. There, we also have the Mount Edgecombe High School in Juneau and Sitka, which is supported by the state, and it's sometimes included and sometimes isn't. And I'll have to check to make sure whether that counts. It's probably not included here because it's not a school district. But that's also part of state spending on public education.
Thank you.
Please continue. Follow up with.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I'm trying to sort this out a little bit, because we have the census number and we have the deed number, mm-hmm. which are different. And there's been one of the deed calculation is that we spend the highest amount per pupil in the classroom, mm-hmm. in the country. And I've been working on trying to figure out what those differences are. Mm-hmm. It looks to me like there's a chart of accounts that's slightly different between what the census data is, mm-hmm. and what the state data is. And the way I understand it, the health care costs for teachers is not included in this number, where it is in the deed number, and that's where it makes that's where the big disparity comes in. But I think it's relevant maybe not specifically to this discussion, but to the understanding for the whole committee as we go over exactly what's happening in education, so we have a sense of where the differences are between data that were being presented today and the data we were presented last week or a couple weeks ago.
Thank you. Through the chair, this does, you see this light green line or something? I don't know what color that is, light green. This does include employee benefits, and we'll take a look at those later on in this presentation. And so employee benefits would include health care benefits in this accounting system here.
Please continue.
Okay. So, and to be clear, the focus of this presentation was, and I apologize if this is what the committee had requested, look at the proportion spent on instruction or to look at, the instruction versus other costs. Our focus was the total spending more than that, and we would defer to other institutions to help us break down what should be accounted for. I did bring this to the community cost differentials. It's a little blurry, as I said before, but as you can see, the turquoise color or the light blue, whatever. Sorry, I wish I should review my colors. A significant amount of the state geography, you can find costs that ICER estimated at more than 1.5 times what Anchorage costs, and then the darker blue, places the cost between 120% to 150% of the cost of Anchorage. And so it really is hard to look at just straight up dollars without taking into account how much more expensive some of these places are. So to take that into consideration when we interpret spending, and again, I'm sort of looking at the length of the whole line rather than how the costs break down within it, but so you see my previous slide is Alaska's number 6, you've got the average there. But when we adjust to do this, Dr. Berman weighted the cost multiplier across the state to Anchorage. And when we do that, it doesn't include adjustments for the small school sizes, but when we just adjust by the Anchorage cost multiplier, we come out number 12 relative to, in our total spending, relative to other districts. And the number there was 14,592. And then knowing that Anchorage is still more expensive than the national Anchorage, we adjusted the previous slide to the Anchorage cost of living index, which is about 23.8%, which is 23.8%. And so when we do that, we kind of can't rank anymore, because if we were to, when we adjust to these averages, other states would adjust too. I mean, you look at some of the places on these graph, DC, New York, those places, Connecticut, they have higher cost of living indexes as well. So that's why the arrow to the U.S. Average where Alaska is adjusted and the average are both in the same color. Those are the bars you can kind of compare at this point. And when we do that, we're at $219 difference per pupil spending than the national average when we make those adjustments. But adjusted or not, we do pay for education, and so we wanted to see what makes up that $17,000, $17,500. And so I should say what makes costs higher in Alaska on this slide. It's not higher per pupil teacher salaries. I'll take a closer look at that. And it's also not extra contributions to retirement systems. Those are legacies. These are outside of district budgets. The evidence that I was going to present today is that it is small schools, healthcare costs, which have already been brought up, energy costs, and then I've already talked about the geographic cost differential. And all of a sudden, I sound like I'm from New Jersey. So per pupil teacher salaries, this is just teacher salaries, not instruction that, it's not the 76% instruction that you talked about, just teacher salaries as a part of this formula. I took the first bar on that previous slide and isolated those. If we look straight up at per pupil teacher salaries, Alaska is 14 in the nation, dollars to dollars. When we adjust to Anchorage, we're at number 23. And again, you have to compare red circle to red circle here. You can't compare the adjusted to the U.S. average as a rank anymore until we could adjust the other 50 states to their cost of living. But when we adjust to the U.S. average, the proportion of our budget that goes to teacher salaries is 23% below that average. If you look at the teacher salary differentials we developed in 2015, I'd like to point out we can talk a little bit more. I've got a slide about how much higher we think instructional salaries should have been at that time, but they weren't implemented. And so when you look at those numbers, they were not actually put into place following that work. So I said it's not per pupil teacher salaries, but with healthcare costs, and to contribute to this slide, did I skip something?
No.
I went from 19 to 21. I was going to talk about small schools, so I'll just tell you about it, and then I'll send you the slide. How did that happen? 1921. Odd. Okay. So of the 443 regular schools in Alaska, and I'm using that number, it's different than the 500 I talked about before. The Regional Education Lab gave testimony in 2017 looking at regular schools. So this excludes schools in correctional facilities and specialized vocation schools and those types of things. But looking at those, 58 in 2017 had fewer than 25 students. That's 13% of the schools in the state. And 34 schools, which is an additional 8%, had between 26 and 50 students. So that means, using their numbers, 92 schools in Alaska, 21% of our schools, are quite small by any standard. These schools are, the 25 or fewer students are spread across 22 districts, so it's not isolated to any particular geographic part of Alaska. Most of these are accessible only by air. They serve a lot of low-income students and a high population of Alaska Native students. And those schools are more costly to operate. I already said that's like 21% of our regular schools. They have high community cost of living, which I talked about in the earlier slides. They don't benefit from economies of scale in capital costs, and they tend to have relatively small class sizes. Obviously, with 25 students, you've got little classes. And those places also have other things that are expensive, like high teacher turnover and high principal turnover. So I don't know why I have this slide and you don't. I'll get you a copy if you'd like.
Yes, we would. We would. Okay. Thank you.
So, all right. But to healthcare costs, and for this, I got some input from my colleague, Dr. Gatabi, who's not online. But he's a healthcare economist, and we can say, as Representative Johnson noted before, that Alaska healthcare costs are the highest in the nation, and that's not an issue that's unique to education. This negatively affects private and public sectors, and so as he notes,
excuse me, Representative Zilkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. DeFeo, I would appreciate when you follow up with slide 20, maybe some context about why Alaska is obligated to pay for operation of those schools. What I don't see reflected in the presentation this morning is maybe a brief recap of some of the court cases that Alaska has had as it relates to education. And I think that it's really important, as we have these conversations around context, that we understand the backdrop of why those obligations to Alaska exist.
So, through the chair, thank you. In one of the supplemental pieces that came in this link, there's an article that goes through the settlements, most recently the Moore settlement, and I think there's a nice and comprehensive overview of that. I am happy to summarize that for you as well. But for sure, I agree.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
So, okay, I'm just making a note so I don't forget to send you that.
Representative Rivak.
Thank you, through the chair. With healthcare costs, I'm curious, do folks in the Department of Education, are they on the Alaska plan, or what kind of healthcare plans do they have?
So, through the chair, my understanding is the state public employees are on the state's healthcare system.
Who are they insured by, do you know, through the chair?
So,
My understanding is it varies from districts what health care plan they're using.
Okay.
Are they allowed to be on the Alaska care plan, through the chair? Does anybody know?
Through the chair, this is definitely outside of my expertise area, and I could follow up on that, but I don't know.
I'd be interested, because it's a good plan. It's the same plan that we have. Would be interested to see if that would cut costs or not.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. DeFeo, I don't believe your numbers include the Department of Education figures. Is that correct? Your numbers here are only including school districts' numbers.
Numbers on, I'm sorry, through the chair,
any numbers. Yeah, so any numbers. Healthcare costs, all of that stuff is all about school districts. This is not about the Department of Education.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is separate from school districts.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, and the only state employees in the school system are department employees, not school district employees.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is for the chair. My understanding, because this is important, my understanding is that the deed, I had my office look into it, that the deed numbers have another component. Maybe it is something to do with administration that it goes into their numbers to get the 76% going into the classroom, as opposed to the census data saying that 54% goes into the classroom. 22% disparity between Alaska Department of Education presentation and the census is a big disparity. I had the chart of accounts. My understanding, I got a sense of what the chart of accounts were that they pull the census numbers from, the chart of accounts that they pull the Department of Education numbers from, and they pull some different accounts into their accounting. If we could get a breakdown of where the Department of Education gets their numbers and where the census gets their numbers, so we can actually compare apples to apples in this discussion. And it's not fair to the presenters to try to grill them on, you know, the differences between other people's numbers, but it would make it a lot clearer for me, because certainly when I go back to my district, I hear over and over and over again, we spend the highest amount on education and we have the lowest outcomes. I've heard that once, I've heard it lots of times. Now, when I look at the chart that we had up here, we're not spending the most on education throughout the country. And so those are just numbers that somehow we need to have those so we can speak intelligently to those kinds of questions.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. And yes, I think that's important that we talk about that, and we can schedule that at another meeting to have that clarification by the different groups. So thank you for that. And also, Representative Rivak, that was a good question about health care. And I think through the different negotiated agreements, there are different health care plans, and it would be good, I think, a topic of discussion at one of our committee meetings about health care costs in various districts and what plans they're using. So thank you.
Hey, Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Tuck.
I think, I guess, the best way probably to approach this is to look and see what the U.S. Census Bureau surveys, so get the survey questions. I think that would be helpful to the committee. And then those other Department of Education or Development find out what they're surveying, so that we can see, oh, these guys are including this, these guys are not including that, or whatever it happens to be. But I think knowing what the survey is asking for may help us out quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Thank you all for that. Please continue. It's 9 o'clock, and we're doing good. This is very good information and important for our knowledge, so thank you.
Okay. So I'll just move quickly in respect to time. Basically, our benefits costs are using the chart from before and adjusting those. Our benefits costs in Alaska are the fourth highest in the nation, and I'm missing a percentage sign in this slide. But when you adjust, after all the adjustments I did before, and you look at benefits, instruction benefits, they're 11% above the national average. And if you remember, we were, I think, 23% below in salaries, so there's an opportunity there. And when you start with a fixed budget, the challenge is that increasing prices in healthcare put downward pressure on wages, and that makes it really hard for us to compete for teachers in that situation. So another reason that we have high costs in Alaska, the 17.5, is energy. It's expensive and it's variable, so fuel costs more in remote places. The costs of fuel fluctuate a lot from place to place, and districts have different capacities to actually negotiate competitive prices. And when it comes to electricity, the power cost equalization does not benefit districts as it does households in communities where electricity costs more. So there's variable costs of energy and variable amounts needed. It costs
You need more fuel to heat buildings in really, really cold places. And regardless of the number of students who are in the building, you still need to heat it. And so those costs contribute as well.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Dr. DeFeo, in that, in all of your charts on spending, mm-hmm. In that other section, is that where included, where energy costs are included?
Yes, it's in the other. That energy is other on the graph. And so, if you wanted to see, it's that dark green bar, and it's big, and energy right. is in there.
And transportation and that sort of thing, is that where that's those costs are located? And I'm actually quite surprised that schools don't benefit from power cost equalization. That is, mm-hmm. that's a shocking statistic to me.
So, through the chair, we were looking at that. We were looking at code on Friday, and in fact, it specifically notes that the districts are exempted or not able to benefit from it. So,
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I'm sure we're getting into an area that's not specific here, but I guess one of the concerns that I have heard in some places is that the school is a large consumer of the fuel, right? So they're the number one consumer of the school. The school's number one consumer of fuel in a number of places, and therefore they actually drive the cost of fuel to a village or to any place. It's hard to, you know, where you got fuel costs being so high. I guess I know this isn't your area, but I mean, at some point we need to understand if we're overpaying for fuel and actually driving the cost up for people that are living there, because the school pays more and they set the price, we're actually driving the cost for the rest of the community. And we can drive that up. And I think that's one of the things we have to be aware of with our large contracts that we have out there, that we can actually cause harm to the rest of the community by driving the cost up. That's just a simple thing that sometimes maybe we just don't think about.
Dr. DeFeo.
Through the chair, I intend to address that a little bit.
Okay.
It's not my expertise area, but it's a noted challenge, and ICER has got a comment to that, okay. So let me get to that.
Representative Tuck.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think it might be helpful, but I would think that having an anchor tenant would bring the cost down. I mean, without that, you won't have bulk shipments. You have smaller shipments, which means per gallon you're paying a lot more to ship fuel. So I don't know. I mean, it'd be interesting to know that, but I would think that having an anchor tenant helps the communities.
Representative. Notes on our follow-ups here. So, please continue.
Okay. Thank you. So I can shift gears now a little bit to talk about opportunities, and finally I'm in an area where I'm more confident I've contributed to the studies that follow, but particularly looking at opportunities that existing ICER research can enhance and illuminate. So as I present opportunities, I'll note that we need more research. I offer these as sort of starting places for discussion. So what I do note in pulling all of this together is that many of the big costs are beyond education policy. We talked about healthcare, we talked about fuel and operating costs, and in reality, the basket of goods that we can purchase in Alaska, I mean, it just costs more to be here. Stuff costs more in rural, remote Alaska, stuff costs more in Anchorage. These are realities that we can't change. When we look at ed policy, one of the few areas, so what's left? Like, what can we look at straight up with ed policy? Teacher salaries are one of the few places that we have any flexibility, but we're concerned about this because salary is critical to the student achievement outcome objectives that I was asked to speak to, and our ability to recruit and retain teachers. Other states are increasing teacher salaries, and so we don't see that as the place to go. student achievement is directly related to teacher quality. There's ample research on teacher turnover and student achievement, teacher quality and student achievement, some in Alaska, plenty in the lower 48. And Alaska,
Representative Zilkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just stepping back to slide 24, and Dr. DeFeo, I don't mean to had a lot of questions and comments on your presentation, which I think means that it's a very good one and it's a very timely conversation. I think one opportunity for policy opportunities that's not reflected up here that I heard from several school districts and school boards that were meeting with us last week is the importance of having reliable funding for school districts, right? Cool. So we see the challenge as it relates to teacher salaries. We see the challenges as it relates to quality benefits that aren't significant cost drivers to school districts. But one thing that has been mentioned over and over by advocates of education is that not having reliable funding from the legislature creates a very volatile environment for recruitment and retention of their employees. And so I guess I would just make a suggestion and a note that that is a policy opportunity that's not reflected here.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was on that teacher recruitment and retention and a policy opportunity of lowering teacher salaries where it said we were already adjusted for cost of living and everything, we were 23% below the national average on that. There was a study, and I believe ICER did it a few years ago, where it said that training a new teacher costs an additional $21,000 on top of what those salaries are and what it costs in the classroom. Would that be negatively impacted and see that cost more, implemented more if we lower teacher salary, thereby impacting recruitment and retention?
Through the chair, as a quick response to Representative Zilkowski, I was not meaning that these are the exhaustive list. So, every time a teacher turns over, we have those costs to just get someone new in the classroom, but we also lose a tremendous amount of the skill that teacher has. There's research that says different things, but typically they say teachers sort of really, you know, that their growth in effectiveness is sort of exponential over the first 5 years, and they continue to get better and better as time goes on, but 5 years is sort of your sweet spot when teachers sort of hit their stride, and if we can't keep teachers that long, we're losing all of the productivity that those teachers have to produce strong student outcomes. So.
Yes.
Thank you. And I know that oftentimes, I don't mean to get further out of the weeds on this, but oftentimes there's a discussion of the defined benefit, defined contribution system that allows teachers to leave when they're vested at 5 years, exactly when they're starting to become those expert teachers. Mm-hmm. Do you have any numbers on where those teachers might, when they might be leaving the school system, how many years they've worked in the school district before they leave?
Through the chair, this is a study that ICER would like to do, especially one of our economists has posed this. We're at an interesting point. I think we're about, at about 15 years out, so we're at the point where people are, as our director says, they have those golden handcuffs on that they can't move if they're in the old retirement system, and people who are at about the same spot, but on the new system, have that opportunity. So it presents a nice opportunity to really look at far enough out when these things really start to affect people's decisions to stay or go. We're poised to do that research, but we haven't done it yet. So it's unclear how that rich system encourages people to come in the first place and how it affects our ability to retain people in the long run. I think that's a study that's been brought up as needed a couple of times, but I couldn't speculate. We'd need to actually do the research.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. So also to Representative Zilkowski, a study that we were asked to do was what happens when teachers get pink slips when the budgets are uncertain, and how does that affect our ability to retain, and how many people would have stayed had that had their employment been a little more certain? Another interesting question, trickier methodologically, I think, to do than the one I was just speaking of, but I mean, I can say it can't be a good thing. It can't be good for morale or for people's long-term planning. So definitely the budgets, that's come up in many, many different ways, but pink slips with teachers are a big one as they relate to my research in particular. So I will just note that Alaska has a teacher turnover problem. I've testified about this before, and it's like a perfect storm. In the lower 48, we have low teacher production. Fewer people are enrolling in education programs, and so we have few teachers just coming out of the system. Alaska hires most of its teachers from the lower 48, 80 to 85% of its new hires every year. The economy in the lower 48 is booming, so districts are adding teachers, adding class sizes, and offering more competitive salaries. And since we import so many of our teachers from the lower 48, we're competing in a national market. So we have to, I think, keep in mind that when we want teachers to come to high poverty schools, unfamiliar geographic places, new cultural contexts, it costs more to get a teacher to go to a high need place than to go to the suburbs. It just does, that's the reality of it. What we need to be able to do with teacher hires is to attract them to come here in the first place, and that's a big part. But then we want them to stay once they get here. And it's not just bringing any old person, it's a good teacher, you know, bringing a good teacher to come in the first place. And that's a big challenge for Alaska. And it doesn't say it on this slide, but we've got a principal turnover problem and a superintendent issue in Alaska as well. So looking at some ICER research that I got to be a part of, and I'm finally so glad to finally be at the part where I contributed to the research and I'm speaking from my own knowledge base. The work we did in 2015, we calculated that statewide Alaska teacher salaries then were about 15% below where they should be. Now that study's going on almost 5 years old, so we'd want to redo that, but about 15% below where they should be. And so the right salary that any teacher needs is going to vary by community and by the working conditions there. And so when we looked at, in our modeling, which Dr. Berman worked on, the highest and lowest recommended teacher salaries, and there was 116% difference between the highest and lowest communities in Alaska, because these were done at the community level, not the district level. These were never implemented. We don't know how they would work. This is modeling, right? So it's you know, there's modeling, and then there's the real world and all the other variables. But there's an opportunity to attract these teachers and retain them, salary is a part of it. But other research that we've done is that it's not just about improving salaries, it's also about improving working conditions. And working conditions are a bigger predictor of teacher turnover than salaries. So I think it's a both and. We need to do both of those things. Reducing turnover is an opportunity for the state, not only in cost savings, but you know, the immediate ones of not having to do teacher turnover costs, but also in the performance productivity that comes with teachers who are seasoned and stay. And so we would encourage the state to invest in retention and tenure. We did some cost calculations that have come out in two papers. Actually, one I didn't supply to you. I'm happy to send it to you. But tenure is a cost saving to the state. It's a benefit that's applied in most other states. Similar policy to Alaska, and diminishing those benefits would be a significant and pretty recognizable cost pretty quickly.
Representative Hopkins.
Two quick questions. I would love to see that study about the how tenure saves districts money.
Okay.
I can understand the logic behind it. I'd love to see what those numbers are. And then you touched on working conditions as almost as important as salaries. Mm-hmm. What are some of those working conditions examples, and can you go into that in a little bit more in depth?
Sure. So through the chair, about tenure, you know what, I'm not, two numbers are in my head and they're not the same, about what you'd have, what it's worth to teachers per year. But to the working conditions, I'm thinking of some work that was done by Dr. Hirschberg at ICER, and I've used her research in some of my own. Working conditions include the leadership in the school is one of the big ones, so the quality and leadership of the principal. community school relationships, whether they're strong or weak. Class size, workload, and things that lead to burnout, especially in small communities where people teach, you know, multiple grades and things like that. And housing conditions for teachers living in those communities as well, because a lot of them are in district housing. Off the top of my head, those are the ones I can think of, but if Lexi is still on the phone, I believe she also worked on that survey data, and she might be able to fill in a few I missed.
Are those in the same paper, the working conditions examples and the 10-year savings, are those in the same report?
Through the chair, they're not, but I can send you both papers. Yeah.
Thank you.
Ms. Hill, did you want to comment?
I think Dana got a pretty comprehensive list.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I really appreciate Representative Hopkins' question on that, because I thought maybe a third category right there would be respect, but it sounds like you've got community school relationship as part of those working conditions. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you that it's unfortunate, but a friend of mine's daughter is one. I don't want to say it's unfortunate she wants to be an educator, but it's unfortunate that he has recommended her not to be an educator, and that she's going to marry somebody wealthy. And I think that just talks about the national trends of not treating teachers with the respect that they deserve. And it's demoralizing. We put them in terrible working conditions. We pay them lousy salaries. And, you know, here in Alaska, they are required to have master's degrees. And so we rely on teachers' passion to want to teach more than we're willing to compensate them for. And unfortunately, I don't remember what the statistics is, but I think it's like 60-something percent within the first 3 years of their teaching careers leave. And so I think that's something that we need to solve here in the state of Alaska, is really how do we get those who want to have a passion to teach to continue teaching and make it a lifelong career, not just a temporary career. Thank you.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's my understanding that among the working conditions in the community is access to the internet. And that's a problem not only for schools, health facilities, and so on, but in terms of access for young teachers coming from remote from far away and being unable to stay in touch with their families back home. I understand that that is a huge issue. Has ICER taken a look at any of those issues regarding broadband access in fact in every community in Alaska, and how that ties into working conditions, in addition to the cost? The cost is astronomical in small communities for very poor, generally very poor access, and that creates problems not only for schools in order to be able to deliver the best, but for employee retention at every level.
Through the chair, anecdotally, I know that's a significant issue. I do some other research on distance education to rural and remote rural communities, and that's a significant challenge there. I know that the study we did looked at, and this is Dr. Hirschberg's work, and if Lexi wants to chime in, looked at feelings of isolation, and those were expected to be high. Whether or not internet access was part of our survey, I don't know. I heard what I thought was someone maybe going to say something, a little crackle.
So internet access was not specifically part of our survey, and it certainly didn't emerge in the qualitative answers that we got. But that survey, internet use and like mobile phone internet use has changed quite notably. And, you know, broadband just keeps getting faster since our survey. So this could have been not such a big deal 5 years ago, which is about when we did that survey. And it could be a huge deal now. We just don't know, because I think the ways in which especially digital natives use the internet have really changed. And there is some research, again, from a little too long ago, from our former director, Heather Hudson, on specifically broadband access to rural Alaska. And she's done some more recent work, but it's more the Canadian Arctic. So I know there is research out there on broadband access. It's not ICER's research at the moment, but we can try to dig that up as well.
Representative Drummond.
Dr. Hill, did you use digital natives? Did I hear you say that?
You did hear me say that.
Can you explain that term, please?
Digital native is more, it's not a technical term, really. It's more a journalistic term to refer to young people who have grown up using the internet since they were very small and are therefore much more, I guess I would say, looking at it as maybe an old fogey, much more immersed in it day to day, very accustomed to doing all their banking on their phone and, you know, using payment methods that are either phone or other internet based. Just people who are super, super comfortable with adopting the latest improvements in internet technology.
Madam Chair, just final comment on that. I can't believe that access, technological access, was not a consideration in looking at housing and working conditions. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if it's part of salaries, but I don't know if it's versus defined. 5 years. That part of salary.
Opportunity. I'll skip back to slide number 27, but to look. Total numbers, it would get more into the distribution of the numbers and how.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on your slide where it says that Alaska teacher salaries about 15% below where they should mm-hmm. be, are you talking about compensation, total compensation, or just salaries?
So I believe that's just salary. Oh, I'm sorry, through the chair, I believe that's just salary. Berman is going to clarify for me.
Yes, Dr. Berman, did you want to clarify that?
Yes, Madam Chair. That was just salary. We had, because the when we did that study, we had the contracts for each school district, and some of them had very different ways in which they're paying for health care, so it was impossible to include the benefits because of that, so it was just salary. But the question is a very good one, and obviously that's important, and if we did the study again, we would want to try to include the benefits. We did look at other, that study also looked at some other benefits and working conditions that were important in addition to salary, And I do recall that housing was one of them, but healthcare, we said again, we didn't have enough systematic information to include it, unfortunately.
Thank you. Please continue.
So to Representative Johnson's comment earlier, fuel and energy is an area of opportunity. As I said previously, districts have different capacities to negotiate these prices. And because the price has changed, that makes fiscal planning quite difficult. And so an opportunity to consider, and of course, we'd want to do a little more research here, but if there could be state negotiated fuel prices, removing that from the state funding formula so that this could be kind of a given and covered, that's an opportunity to explore how that might help districts to budget. Sure. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Representative Zolkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has this particular opportunity for consideration been vetted with rural, well, Alaska? In the context of this presentation that we've heard this morning, you've indicated that Alaska as a state is rural in comparison to our other states in our nation, but has this particular item with regard to rural hub or remote rural communities, has this particular discussion point been vetted with any of the school districts that would potentially be impacted by this?
So, through the chair, that's an excellent question. I know that this was first sort of brought up by ICER the last.
Ms. Hill.
I missed the specifics of the question.
So, Ms. Hill, my question was, has the suggestion about state negotiating fuel prices and removing fuel from the foundation formula, has that been vetted with rural school districts across Alaska?
Those are two separate comments. One was actually suggested to me a couple of years ago and to several others by some folks from the Association of School Business Officers as a potential area of cost savings. The suggestion about removing fuel from the foundation formula, the short answer is, has not been vetted with school districts.
Follow up?
Nor has it been formally made by ICER. It is certainly something we have talked about due to the volatility of fuel prices.
Representative Zolkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a representative for a rural district like District 38, which is largely a rural hub as well as remote rural communities, when it comes to the delivery of fuel every spring, that's done through private industry, which is largely an unregulated industry in Alaska. And my preference as a legislator that represents a rural district would be, in terms of considering opportunities, are there opportunities to find some regulations that maybe can be put forward to a very volatile market instead of holding down our school districts in proposals that have not been vetted alongside them? And so I guess I would put that forward not for your response this morning, Dr. DeFeo, but in terms of having a broader conversation about controlling community costs in rural Alaska is not necessarily being driven by state government, but by very volatile markets that are currently not regulated and has been recommended by a lot of rural community leaders as an area and opportunity for some policy consideration. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for that also. So as I said, right on the slide is more research is needed around that. And researchers always recommend more research. But I think it's because we want to get this right, just because our numbers suggest that, you know, there might be a way to go. There's a lot of other things that go into policy making, into politics. So the ICER studies I talked about where these recommendations came from were done for very specific purposes. And I think they inform this discussion, but I offer them more as starting points for discussion in this broader milieu of spending. But I've gone through this slide, and I think to conclude, I think the point is, you know, we need to spend the money well. We could spend a whole lot more and still not produce desired outcomes in education. And so, you know, if it's not just about putting dollars in, it's about putting them in the right places. And on the short term, though, is if we reduce spending without looking at how those dollars are spent and allocated, it's going to likely harm the student achievement outcomes that I was asked to speak to, because it's difficult for the districts to absorb cuts without increasing class sizes and laying off some teachers. And so that's a caution and concern that I'll conclude with.
Dr. DeFeo, are you saying that recognizing the fixed costs that districts have, like I will say Juneau School District, because I'm most familiar with that, 90% of our costs are personnel costs. And so when you look at reducing costs, if you have to, there's not as many things to go to if that doesn't affect personnel in some way.
That exactly. It's personnel costs are big, and instructional salaries are the biggest there. And so if there's a blanket reduction in district budgets, it's going to play out in the teacher layoff or in larger class sizes almost invariably.
Thank you. Do any members have any further questions? Yes, I see Representative Zilkowski and then Representative Tech.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much, Dr. DeFeo, for coming in and presenting this research. I think it's always really important to understand data that is coming from a place of objectivity as we consider some really significant challenges and policy considerations at the state level. I absolutely appreciated seeing some of the overall numbers as it relates to weighting that within the state of Alaska as well as among some of our larger communities. I do, again, just want to emphasize the obligations that the state has in terms of equitable funding of education across Alaska as being, particularly regardless of location, a necessary backdrop to any research or conversation that's done in this dynamic. And that seemed to be missing a bit on slide 4 and teeing it up for throughout the rest of the presentation. So just a comment in terms of opportunities for strengthening this type of work. And then again, with respect to the rural hub and remote rural school districts, they absolutely understand the context and backdrop of all of these conditions better than anyone. And so making sure that their work and efforts as this type of research is presented is highlighted seems really important, because it felt very absent in the presentation that was reflected here today. Mm-hmm. We've heard some of those dynamics as presented in previous standing committee presentations. But I just find it to be absolutely an important context and backdrop to consider as this research is being presented, to make sure that is reflected adequately. So thank you.
Through the chair, thank you for that comment. I apologize if this sounded sort of like a deficit perspective, and we'll send you some work that we've done recently looking at place-conscious work in rural places that really celebrate some of the incredible practices that rural superintendents and rural teachers are using with students. It doesn't roll up into the cost, but I'll have to consider how to make sure that those stories are not lost from this narrative as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and also would like to thank Dr. DeFeo for her presentation and highlighting some of the opportunities as we look forward, where we need to zero in and focus on, one of them being the new cost differential that we should be looking at. As chair of LBNA, I think there's a possibility we can do that through legislative budget and audit, so I would like to put something together and put some to the full joint committee on that, since we do look at investments. We had the chair of the Energy Committee here too, Representative Hopkins. So I think that highlighting some of the cost factors that we have there, and then again sharing with us opportunities and ways that we can have the state help out in negotiations and help out on that, I think is really helpful. So I very, very much appreciate the presentation today, and really helps us in knowing what steps we need to go moving forward. Thank you.
Any other questions? I too would like to thank you for all the information. I'd like to thank Dr. Berman online and Ms. Hill online today. I'm wondering how you communicate, like the information that we gave you today. Is there any way that you will be communicating, putting this information out to the public in any form?
That's an excellent question. As I put the slides together, I was sitting down with my colleague, and she said, you know, we should put out a paper on this. Time is always the challenge. With some corrections to these slides, as suggested, and a more critical lens applied to it, we could certainly make these slides at least available on our website. I would love to promise a paper. I would love to take the time to do that, and I'd love to promise a paper. It's hard to sometimes to make sure that those are going to come out, but I'd like to work with Matt, who did a lot of these calculations, to put something out that's a little more digestible and accessible.
Well, I appreciate that. I think one thing that we, as elected leaders, are charged with sometimes is getting good, adequate information to the public. Mm-hmm. And we've had a lot of questions about our costs and the drivers behind that. And so it is helpful to have a white paper is good, but also just more information out to the public in general. So we can talk about that ourselves as a committee, too. And we had a lot of good questions and follow-up suggestions for future meetings today. So we will look at our notes and try to arrange that. Any more questions, Representative Hopkins?
Yeah, sorry, I had to step out for a minute there. Some of the things I didn't hear discussed much in this presentation were some of the individual cost drivers within the base student allocation and how they do or don't fully fund what the costs actually are. And one of those items is the federal impact aid and how that impacts districts across Alaska. And from my understanding is they don't fully fund the cost of those students that they're supposed to be covering, specifically the ones living on base, some of the Bureau of Indian Affairs money that comes through as well, and that impact aid for rural districts. Are you familiar with how that works and how those costs don't fully fund and why they don't, those students? Can you touch on that, please?
So, through the chair, I'm somewhat familiar, but if Matt Berman is on the line, I was just reading a paper he wrote about this a couple of years ago, and I think he could speak to that much better than I could if he's still here.
Dr. Berman, are you still online? Are you on mute?
Okay, hello, this is Dr. Berman. I can't really answer that question precisely, but there are sort of two basic sources of federal impact aid. One is the like military students on active duty military and their dependents, and the other is the payments in lieu of taxes for federal lands, which Alaska obviously has a lot of, and they combine. So I'm not familiar with exactly how that breaks down.
Follow up.
Yeah, thank you very much. Follow up. From my understanding, is the impact aid gives a certain percentage of what the cost of educating that student is, and then there's an assumption that local taxation rates that those military people would be coming in to that community would help pay if there was local the taxation rates or state broad-based revenue that they would be assuming that would be calculated into that federal impact aid that would be coming in to those districts into that state in addition to what the impact aid is. Are you familiar with how that structure works?
Not precisely, but there's a national formula, and clearly in a district like Anchorage where there might be substantial local revenues, it's different from a place like, I guess, Kodiak, which also would get impact aid for Coast Guard, and they might not have the same tax base. So that's a very good question, but I don't have the answer to it.
All right, thank you. And then another quick follow-up. How does the local revenue and local contribution impact this? These calculations compared to other states around the nation?
That's a, Again, that's a question that every state does something different. In Alaska, we have the required local contribution in the foundation formula, and then the states can, the local districts can supplement that to a limited degree in statute beyond the required local contribution, and that the different states have different ways of doing that. So, you know, on the average, the local contribution is smaller in Alaska than in other states. But when in the state, such as, we'll take an example of states such as like Illinois, where the majority is local, there's obviously a lot greater opportunity for local districts to, you know, their revenues to vary a lot than in Alaska, where it's relatively small. So a percentage of overall or amount of dollars per student, Alaska is relatively low variation compared to other states, simply because the local contribution is only about 12% of the, about 22% of the total, rather than the majority as it is in some states.
Interesting, thank you. And then just one quick follow-up. That also has a lot to do with, correct me if I'm wrong, other states' school districts being able to raise their own revenue and tax their own residents within that school district, while Alaska does not have that authority.
Well, Alaska has, as you know, Alaska has the school districts, when they're borough schools, they're part of the overall borough finances, or in the case of like Anchorage and Juneau, the unified municipalities, they're part of the overall, you know, the overall local tax system. But in most states, school districts are independent of other local governments, and they have their own local taxes, generally property taxes, that are separate from the city government or the county taxes.
All right, thank you.
Once again, thank you, everyone. If there are no further questions, Representative
Tuck. And we failed to actually thank the full ICER team, those that are on the call and everything, for the work, because I know this is a collaborative effort of everybody coming together. So I just want to make sure that they all get the thanks as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. Representative Drummond.
Thank you. I really appreciate looking at the spending compared to the other states and the adjustments that were made. That shows us how terribly different we are and how terribly below the national level of salaries. It's quite eye-opening. Thank you. And I don't see that much difference in the way our school officers have analyzed the figures in the way that the census figures do. I'd like to look at those as well. But I appreciate your bringing those to our attention. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And please pass on our thanks to your colleagues, too, who weren't here today. So, anyway, seeing no further questions or comments, our next House Education meeting will be Wednesday, April 17th at 8 a.m. We will be considering House Bill 128 relating to National Board Certification for Public School Teachers. And if there are any questions that we ask today that we can get information quickly, maybe we can be able to address some of those. Others might take some more time for different groups to get that information together for us. So thank you for good questions today. And with that, we are adjourned at 9:43. Thank you.